Come on, let's go.
By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas capitals,
we are about to broadcast
this moment in our history.
Hello, and welcome to the History Workshop podcast. I'm Mary Beth Hamilton. What might it mean to translate the French Revolution in ways that open it up for the 21st century? What happens if we understand all historical scholarship as an act of translation, in which the foreign country that is the past is rendered rich and explicable in the present day? Those are the questions at stake in two new books, both of which explore the final years of the French Revolution: The Last Revolutionaries, The Conspiracy Trial of Gracchus Babeuf and the Equals, written by the historian Laura Mason, and An Anarchist Playbook, compiled by the members of the Radical Translations Workshop, who've put together an anthology of documents from the final years of the revolution, years marked by virulent schisms over the meaning of private property, social justice, and the practice of radical equality. I sat down over Zoom with four people who brought these books into the world: Laura Mason, Sanya Perovich, Christina Vitti, and Dominic Jakeley. I began by inviting Laura to talk about the historical moment that inspired both of these volumes, the final years of the French Revolution, culminating in the conspiracy trial of a group called the Equals.
So I think the way into this is by talking about the trial that's at the heart of my book, The Last Revolutionaries. So this is a trial that took place in 1797, the waning years of the French Revolution. But this is a period of the French Revolution that very few people know about. Even specialists don't know this period very well. People who might know a little bit about the revolution might think about the taking of the Bastille in 1789, or the period of revolutionary terror when Robespierre led the government in 1793 and 1794. This trial took place in these years that are kind of, that for most people are kind of empty years between the fall of Robespierre and the coup that brought Napoleon Bonaparte to power in 1799. So what I'm interested in is this trial that was brought about by a seditious conspiracy that was organized around a radical journalist named Gracchus Babeuf. And Babeuf and a handful of allies who called themselves the Equals plotted against the conservative government that was in power at that time. And that government was called the Directory. And the reason Babeuf and the Equals were plotting against this government is because they believed it was violating the promises of the French Revolution. It had been created with a new constitution, and that new constitution abolished the universal male suffrage that had been in place. It abolished firm guarantees of free speech and free assembly. It eliminated the promise of a right to work, and it attacked social welfare more generally. So what the Equals wanted to do, what they conspired to do, was they wanted to create a popular insurrection that would overthrow the Directory, restore the democratic constitution that had been in place, and this last point is really crucial for how we remember Babeuf, they wanted to abolish private property. But the Equals were denounced and arrested. And it's in the wake of this denunciation and arrest that I think that this case really tells us a lot about this particular moment in history. The Equals were a fairly small group, and all they had done was distribute pamphlets. That was their most significant act. The Directory grossly inflated the danger that they had posed to make itself look like a guardian of order. So this is an effort by the government to kind of to reinforce itself and strengthen its hand in dealing with what was a kind of fragmented political society. It also used the claim of a terrible threat as an excuse to go after its own critics to the left, so to go after Democrats. And there was a widespread crackdown. There's one historian of the revolution who wrote during the Cold War called this a Red Scare. And I don't think that that's an unreasonable way of describing it. So the Directory thought that this crackdown and inflating the threat posed by the Equals would strengthen it, but in fact, it further deepened the fragmentation of political society, and it really polarized politics. On the one hand, Democrats, a lot of whom had shunned Babeuf up to this point, a lot of Democrats rallied to the equals and started criticizing the case because they saw that the government was badly overreaching and they saw police harassment of Democratic critics and activists across the country. Conservatives and reactionaries took the directory's claims of a terrible threat and ran with them and said that this was proof of the kind of menace that the left continued to pose to France, that France was on the brink of sort of falling into a new terror. And they said that any Democrats who criticized the case were just giving further evidence of how complicit they were in all of this. So this was the context in which the trial unfolded. By the time the trial took place in 1797, hundreds of people had been arrested and 65 people were put on trial. The trial lasted for 3 months and it was really widely covered in the press. As the directory and its prosecutors made the case against the equals, they really seized on this trial as an occasion to advertise their claims. First, they said they were not conspirators. They said they were being persecuted because they were good revolutionaries defending liberty and equality. They criticized the directory every chance they got with impromptu speeches, prepared speeches, and challenged the directory, saying it was an enemy of democracy and popular welfare. And they also challenged the proceedings of the trial as unfair. They would call attention to judges' motions that really sort of obviously favored the prosecution. They claimed that witnesses against them had been bribed. They claimed that documents that seemed to implicate them were forged. And I think really importantly, they argued that they had not done anything seditious. All they had done was use their rights of free speech to educate citizens about how to establish and preserve good government. So the trial was just an incredible spectacle, and the Democratic press at the time followed it very closely and published accounts of the trial that both gave a sense of what was happening in the courtroom but favored the defendants. In the end, most of the charges were dismissed. Charges were dismissed against the vast majority of defendants. Again, this deepened polarization because Democrats said, well, if the charges were dismissed against most of the defendants, it's proof that those who were condemned were railroaded. They were innocent too. And they celebrated Babeuf as a martyr to democracy. Reactionaries and conservatives, on the other hand, said that the few condemnations proved that everyone had been guilty. And so this demonstrated the government's weakness, and it suggested that scores of determined revolutionaries had been loosed once more on French society. The long-term implications of this case were that the idea of Babeufism, the sort of cause of Babeuf and the equals, became a really problematic label that continued right up to the end of the revolution, and in fact, a little bit beyond the revolution's end. Democrats celebrated Babeuf as a martyr to democracy, but they were very careful to distance themselves from his opposition to private property. Conservatives and reactionaries used the label of Babeufiste to paint their political opponents, the Democrats, as dangerous radicals. So there was this kind of caricaturing of the left using the label of Babeufiste. Most seriously, the regime itself, the directory, used claims of Babeufism to justify its mounting attacks on civil liberties. It closed newspapers, it closed political clubs, and to justify electoral tampering. It purged voters from electoral rolls, it discouraged organizing, and in the end, it suppressed the results of several elections. This fostered cynicism about democratic process so that in 1799, when a number of political insiders organized the coup that brought Napoleon to power, very few people protested. So I think the trial, sort of quite generally, I think the trial is important in suggesting both the debate over the nature of the republic, that the French Revolution had founded and how polarization weakened and destroyed the Republic in very few years.
I mean, listening to you talk about it, the stakes of this were so high. Why has it been so neglected?
Well, I think there are two reasons. I think in part because of the history and historiography around Babeuf himself, and also the way the directory has been discussed until quite recently. I think that I see my book as being part of a change in scholarship that's sort of emerged since the turn of this century. But let me talk about Babeuf first. So in the middle of the 19th century, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels labeled Babeuf, they described him as something like the first modern communist. They said that, you know, the equals were the first sort of activist communist party. And they said that because Babeuf did not see communism as a utopian project, like someone like Thomas More sort of imagined, oh, a utopia where no one has private property. Babeuf believed that it was possible to organize politically to bring into being a system without private property. And that label really stuck. And so really until the end of the 20th century, most of the scholarship about Babeuf has been about the nature of his communism and the organizing of the conspiracy. And so it's been what I see as a kind of internalist history. It has enormous riches, but it's also by focusing so narrowly on Babeuf and the equals, it kind of takes them out of the context of the French Revolution and is looking forward to the 19th century. So I'm really interested in Babeuf as a French revolutionary and what he can tell us about these final years of the revolution. Why haven't these years been talked about very much until the turn of this century? I think largely because there was an older scholarship about the directory that really tended to focus on the men in government. And so there were conversations about who were the executives. It was a peculiar executive. There were five executives, not one. So there was a lot of history. Who were the executives? What did they think they were doing? And it was a history that also kind of adhered to what the executives had said about themselves. They said, well, political society was already polarized. And so we had to continually strike against the right and the left to like keep the republic on the straight and narrow. So I think it was really this focus on political elites that prevented us from telling broader, more interesting, more dynamic, more complex stories about what's happening at the end of the French Revolution. So, and hopefully this is just a beginning.
Yeah, well, in that vein, I mean, we've got a second volume dealing with this same period, the Anarchist Playbook. And I wondered if the three of you could introduce yourselves in the course of introducing the volume, starting off as well with the Radical Translation Workshop itself, the kind of community out of which it emerges.
Yeah, so I guess I'll introduce myself first, just because I can give a context that's both institutional and historical for our project. And then I will let Christine and Dominic talk about the workshops and the process in more detail. So my name is Sonia Perovic, and I teach in the literature department at King's College London. Yes, this is a book that had two origins, I would say. One is a research project that I'm leading at King's College London, and it's called Radical Translations. And this is a project that looks at the role of translation in communicating radical revolutionary ideas of liberty and equality between France, Italy, and Britain in the time period. And as part of this project, because we were looking at translation, we also wanted to ask a related question, which is, how do people think about revolution today? Because it's my impression that the French Revolution as an event that's of world importance is fading, and that a lot of historiography nowadays, of course, Laura Mason accepted, but, and I've also worked in the French, I work in the French Revolution as well, but that generally we are not the focus of attention in the historical field generally. People have moved and they ask different questions. So we wanted to see what young people today thought about revolution, but we didn't want to be teachers of the history, because that's what they do in history class. We wanted to really confront them with revolutionary language. We think, as a team and my other colleagues that run the project, and Christina, of course, as well, we think that revolutionary language is something that in a way escapes its historical origin and has traveled far and wide in different ways, of course. And that's partly where we come into this project. So I said there was two origins. That's one of them. The other one is that we had done a performance in 2015 with a French theater director where we tried to perform a play called The Last Judgment of All Kings by someone called Sylvain Maréchal, who's not Babeuf, but knew Babeuf. And this was a really eye-opening experience for me because the students had to translate the play. It's a one-act play, so it's in our publication. It's towards the end. But in performing it, what we realized very quickly is that you can't really perform. The play ends with a volcano that explodes and kills all the monarchs and the Pope. And, you know, it's the utopian moment coming to be. And it was a very popular play in the French Revolution that was performed in 1793. But we realized we can't actually stage the volcano today. We actually don't have an end to history in that way. And the question that arose there was, and the director had the idea that the only way we can really talk about utopia nowadays is to not stage a volcano on stage, but to have a discussion about it. And he had invited some grassroots activists that had never encountered the play before to come to the performance. And instead of performing the end of the play, we actually had a discussion with them. So this is a very different departure from a history project. And through that, then we thought, well, let's do another. We'd really like to have students think about the Manifesto of Equals, which is a text that was in Buonarroti's papers. It's also, I think historians do agree that it was probably penned by Sylvain Maréchal, but perhaps with Babeuf, there's some kind of statements there that repeat that you find in both of their writings. And that was our first text that we wanted students to work with. And then from there, we started to explore more deeply the conspiracy itself. So for us, it wasn't the conspiracy per se that was the beginning. It was a broader question, I think, about revolution, its place in today's consciousness, and utopia as something that's very difficult to conceptualize. And that's what then gave rise to our further interest in the conspiracy of equals. And we looked at other writings from there. And we tried to find a variety of different languages that were used by the conspirators. That was kind of in our book, we didn't do it all. We just took a few things and focused on different types of language. And then the other thing I would say, the workshops, and Christina will say more about this, but these workshops have taken place now over a period of 4 years with several generations of students. And I had never experienced a translation workshop before of this kind of attention. And I would say that what really struck me was A, the attention paid to anyone who ever does translation seriously, but B, what it means in a workshop to have maybe 20 or 10 or 15 young people discussing every line of a text written 200 years ago and thinking about what it means today. Can you have a meaning? Can you translate it into ways that we understand it today? And this to me was a fascinating process. So I have a job as an academic, let's say, and I wanted to see what translators and students and performers and other people who have a different relationship to language, what they did with the text like that. So it's an experimental project with a basis in history. And one last thing I would just say, this moment of 1797, 1796, because we're working on a translation project, this moment of closure that happened in France, it wasn't the end of the story, of course, because when the French Revolutionary Armies went to Italy, and of course, Christina's Italian as well, but that's one aspect of our project. That was a moment where people rediscovered the Constitution of Year Two. They talked a lot about it. There was a moment of opening in other places. So our vision of revolution is more of something that even though there might be this quite radical closure in one area, some of the ideas traveled quite far and were able to be reopened in a different context. So I think it's this movement that we're very interested in. And this fascinating relationship to the Constitution of Year Two, which was published and translated in fragments and talked about and traveled far and wide, is also something that we're very interested in.
Christina, did you want to step in?
My name is Christina Vitti, and I've practiced translation for long years. in many different fields, literature, poetry mostly. I was very, very interested in this project simply because of wanting to continue practicing as an answer to that all-important question, or as Susan Sontag put it, where is that I, with the skills I have, with my background, with my taste and constitution, can bring my most radical contribution to discourse. The role of a translator is that, at best, to bring a contribution in repairing any links, any broken links in discourse. If we were to put it with Shelley, in this great arc of conversation that minds are engaged into across the centuries, there are sometimes interruptions, there are broken links, and this is ideally what we might want to think of ourselves as doing. So it was wonderful to become part of this project, and also to, on a personal level, to counter that more hermit-like part of the practice that calls for total solitude with an open and lively interaction with younger people, with students, and in particular, working in collaboration on strictly defined texts. So that's where we came from. And also in our conversations, we spoke of the need of the great interest that we all had in sort of constellating this field that can sometimes come across as very empty. That reminds me, or it brings me back to something you said, Laura, in your previous book on the songs of the revolution. You say, you know, we are offered accounts and we have memories put together by people who maybe concentrate on much more on political elites, as you said, but what was happening in the street, what was happening in the cafe, in the cafes, what were people singing, saying, and above all, who were those figures in those years, and by extension, of course, onwards, who were so deeply embedded in the culture that sometimes they are like foundational elements in a building. You don't see them, but they're holding that fabric together. That was the sort of first impulse for me personally to want to join the project.
And Dominic.
Hello, I'm Dominic Jakeley. I'm the publisher behind Tenement Press. And yeah, I'm a longtime collaborator of Christina's. We've worked on titles together previously. And I came into the Radical Translations project relatively late in the process. The workshops, as Sonia was saying, have been going on for kind of 4 years previous. But there was a real kind of philosophical chime or harmony between what I saw to be going on within the workshops and what I've been trying to kind of ascertain through Tenement Press and its publications, really. Whereas Tenement kind of names itself, there's an architectural metaphor at the core of the project, right? The tenement is key. This is about designing a shared space and really concentrating on the kind of collaborative kernel at play in the act of collaboration and what a conversation can do, the kind of a political edge and angular qualities of the act of publication, and how in the dynamics of a book's movement from place to place and context to context, it sparks different forms of reproach, agreement, combat, conflict, different forms of quiet revolution, I suppose, as it travels. And so to come on board with the Radical Translations, there was something about the non-hierarchical emphasis of the workshops as a paradigm, and how they were looking at a particular moment in history whereby the value of publication was considered to be something not only endangered, but also dangerous, bringing that forward to a new point in history whereby speech, the act of writing, thinking publicly, is something that is coming under a new form of consideration. You know, that there are discussions again at foot every day about free speech, the direction of our speech, what we actually put our language towards, and how open we are with any specific causes that we want to attach ourselves to. I was quite inspired by the concentration that I saw to be going on within the workshop program around this, and how it was concentrating on bringing in kind of a hybrid faculty of translators, professorial staff, students, academics, and sitting that conversation very equatorially. So I was delighted to come on board and really be a part of that collaboration and consider how we could translate that workshop idea and its very atmosphere into something that could sit within a book-length study of such a dynamic and understudied period of history. And through Tenement, we've been looking recently to set up a new imprint through the project called No University Press. And this would be the first title within that particular list. And it's really important to ascertain that the no of No University is not a refusal per se, but is an effort to really kind of embrace the ways in which there is a certain form of enthusiasm and creativity and passion that is brought to bear by the kind of broad arc of these sorts of conversations that is then put to pay by a certain level of formal constraint that kind of accompanies the institution and industry of academic publishing. And what I see Sanya and Christina to really be pioneering through the workshop process is not just a means of considering the kind of historical punctum of revolution and the long history of Babouf's reputation and all these sorts of things, but actually really to consider the ways in which we have a pamphlet culture at its core that just galvanizes its way through to become something other as it moves its way through the 19th and 20th centuries. And so now in the 21st, to kind of deal with that today and think about that as a means of something germinal, so we can, you know, consider the contemporary places of these texts is really key and something I was delighted to work on via Tenement and No University Press.
Can I just say something, just to pick up what Dominic said, just to say, and I think it relates to Laura's work, actually. It strikes me that, and this is something that one of my collaborators also has really emphasized, when you write about revolution, in the French Revolution, it really makes a difference whether you feel sympathy for the protagonists that you're writing about. And in fact, the kind of historiographies we have about this moment will differ depending on how you feel about the people involved and what your point of view is. And I felt strongly reading Laura's book that it was shot through with a strong sense of sympathy and admiration for Babouf, and that lends itself to a certain kind of history, a certain kind of attention that you're willing to pay to certain things. So I think that's also something that we felt by going back to these texts that really are not read and paying attention to them in this very slow 3-hour long workshops. Can you imagine undergraduates are so busy giving up time to do 3 hours of looking, you know, word by word, but that level of attention brings up so much new things, but you have to have a pre-existing desire or sympathy for what you're doing.
Your attention is visible, I think, in the translations, which I think are just lovely. I really enjoyed reading them and the kinds of words and phrases. There was one translating "riche propriétaire" as 1%ers. I thought, these are people who are thinking really hard about the resonance between the 18th and the 21st centuries. But it's interesting listening to all of you speak. I'm suddenly rethinking some of the way I saw the trial. The idea of free speech being dangerous, which we all understand intimately. And I think that to a certain extent, as much sympathy as I have for Babouf and the equals, which is not always an easy sympathy, I think they're all really difficult people, but as much sympathy as I had for them, listening to all of you speak, I suddenly felt that I had been co-opted a little bit by the directory and the prosecutors, that I was always a little bit suspicious of the equals' claim that they were only making use of free speech to educate their fellow citizens. I thought, well, they were conspiring, but I'm doubting that now. I do think, and you know, it's so complex reading through a trial transcript. You're trying to compensate for what you can't see because so much of what happens in a courtroom is embodied, but also sort of trying to read through the defense arguments that the accused were making. And I do think, to kind of restate this, I do think that there is this really sort of complex debate going on about what is sedition? Is seditious conspiracy picking up a gun, or is it just talking to your neighbors and saying, this government is corrupt and we need to change it?
I really come across when I was reading your book how slippery this moment is, partly because everyone is defending themselves in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck when you were writing about Antonelle and how in the actual trial itself, you have a kind of distinction being made between just words, mm-hmm, and Babouf wanting to insist that it was more than just words. And I guess I would have, my question to you would be, I have heard about other arguments that there were, you know, generals in the army that were quite sympathetic to Babeuf, that these Babeuvists went far and wide in the time period as well as after, that maybe there was a moment in which there could have been mutiny or the army could have turned, or how do you, it's impossible, yeah, to know, isn't it? I mean, but what do you make of those arguments that it was actually like quite a tense moment?
Well, there had been this military insurrection that was just kind of vanished once the generals sort of made concessions to the soldiers and sent them home. I've read these arguments that there was really widespread support. I mean, Babeuf and his newspaper, the Tribune du Peuple, Babeuf had a pretty wide readership, an unusually wide readership for a newspaper like that. But I think reading and admiring a newspaper, or reading a pamphlet in the barracks and saying to the other men in the barracks, you know, yeah, this guy's right to sort of call out the government, I think that that's different than being willing to actually take up arms and engage in insurrection. And I do believe that however many readers there were of the Equals out there, and however many people were sympathetic to their ideas and angry at the directory, the government had made the cost of political activism so high. You know, it had dispersed these societies. The repression after the last popular insurrection in 1795, the Prairial Insurrection, people were disarmed, they were imprisoned, they were summarily executed. There had been intermittent famine in Paris for the preceding 2 years. People were scrambling to keep their families alive. And sometimes when they couldn't keep their families alive, they were killing their children and committing suicide. So I think that, I don't think that France was on the brink in the way that some other historians have claimed, and certainly the way that the right claimed at the time. I think the population was exhausted and dispirited and frightened. And that may be why the Constitution had to move to another space, why it went to Italy next. I mean, one of the things I was thinking here at Hopkins, there are a lot of people who talk about Atlantic history, and they talk about Maronage, Maroon communities, people who escaped slavery and went and lived in the mountains. And I started thinking about Maronage as an image that might serve us too, that the Maronage of ideas that when some political societies shut down and become more restrictive, the ideas can sort of slip away and take root somewhere else. And I think that brings it back to the project of translation that all of you are working on, both a translation across time, but also that translation across space.
It does. It, as you speak, I'm just reminded of the course of Karsic rivers, a river that will be impeded, will literally go underground and mm-hmm. come out in a different geological area, simply because it has to follow its course or be deviated, but not lose that current. And so much so that many times we see in the works of single artists, we see that sometimes a change of form is something that's in the work of true artists, not necessarily motivated by anything but the need to keep that intensity going, and therefore the form will change. Mm-hmm. And also here, as we speak, when we are speaking of whether sedition and how sedition is defined, and whether words can constitute in themselves an act of sedition, where we have countless examples where a mere rising of an eyebrow, I'm thinking of the situation in Algeria, the poets who were French Algerians and who had learned the Arabic songs of that time, and that be in a very strange position vis-a-vis both sides, of course, or in the relation with both sides, and sometimes they'd come out or state their affiliation simply by whispering or singing a certain song while they went about their day. And I'm thinking also, we translated the song that Marechal wrote, or you know, co-opting, in fact, or doing what poets have been doing for millennia, taking a melody and changing the lyrics to suit the time. When he speaks of soldiers and then choyer, you know, the soldiers are treated with such favor to keep them within ranks, but beware the day when the soldiers and the people, once again, as they did when the Bastille was taken, should ever come together. So it's we're on that fault line at which one word, and sadly enough, we're seeing the consequences of imprudent speech all around us in areas where a war has already put its boot through people's doors.
And go ahead, Sonia.
Oh, I don't know. I don't have much to add. I think we're a bit intimidated to speak in front of Laura because we don't know the period. You know, we don't know this area so well, and we're not historians. And we naturally work on language and the circulation of ideas through text and through other ways. But of course, there's a whole other story to be told. And just I just wanted to say that what I really also enjoyed about this book was the emphasis on Babeuf's practical experience. Granted, he was in prison a lot of the time, but the idea that the revolution, and this is something that comes across in this book, but also what we're interested in our project on translations is how that it's really helpful to think of revolution and expand the cast of characters that we associate with revolution. Because I think in the popular culture, and also especially in the Anglo sphere, it's like Robespierre and Danton maybe, and you know, maybe the king. Oh, Marie Antoinette, okay, she gets pride of place as well. And maybe Charlotte Corday. And so there's a couple of people here, and you get a very kind of narrow view. And I think what the idea that the revolution opened up loads of opportunities for people to be different kinds of people. And that they didn't know the outcome of some of their experiences. And I think one of the questions that Laura's book raises that we don't really deal with because we're working on something more poetic, I suppose. And poetics is also a type of communication, of course. But the idea that you gained so much experience that people never had once the revolution happened. I mean, you just, what does it mean to be an activist in 1784? I mean, it just wouldn't have even existed in the way that it was able to exist just a decade later. So I think I'm fascinated as an outsider point of view. So I study the revolution, but only from certain elements, that this is this amazing explosion of possibilities. You can call it making careers, almost. New careers, new possibilities, and it's especially actually pronounced in the world of theater, in the world of music, and in things that aren't just, you know, careers as deputies even. Mm-hmm. So in my own work, I'm really interested in really expanding the cast of characters beyond, and these people had overlapping identity, overlapping interests. I mean, the amount of energy these people had is just astonishing. And you'd have actors who became, you know, theater directors who also were activists, what we might call today, but they were all working with things that would have been unimaginable. And that's a fascinating moment. And I think language became something that took on a valence. I mean, the other thing that's fascinating is the new words that were created, the neologism, the new meanings. Like, what does conservative and radical mean even? It's something that the revolution had created. So we're also working on language, and we find it very interesting to think about these, in some sense, very Enlightenment terms, classical terms. By the time you get to 1796 or even 1793, I mean, these words have so many other meanings and associations and connotations, and it's just the extreme opening of this moment, I think, is worth trying to grasp.
I think I love hearing you say that, because that's really what brought me to the study of the revolution in the first place. I still remember when I was 20 years old, the first time I really read about the French Revolution, I was reading this classic, The Coming of the French Revolution by Georges Lefebvre. And I got to his account of the taking of the Bastille, and I was overwhelmed. I thought, where did these ordinary people get this idea that they could besiege the king's fortress? And it was it was really the amazement at that sort of popular energy that drew me into this. And I think too, what you're saying about the radical change in the experience of revolution, that people made careers through the revolution, but the revolution kind of also made them and made their careers. And in this regard, I think of people I know whose careers as academics were derailed in 1968, that they became activists and sort of set aside this university path they had traced. And I think that it's that kind of engagement with your own present that we see during the revolution, that we see with a lot of these equals, that, you know, Babeuf kind of bounces around. There's insurrection taking nearby, so he does what he can for the insurgents. And one of the things he can do is he can write and he can, you know, deliver speeches. And then when he's given a newspaper, he works through that. But there are other people who engage in politics, and then when they're purged from politics, and here I'm thinking of the journalist Azine, who covers the trial, he kind of has this sort of flexibility. Okay, I can't be a member of a government administration anymore. So he sort of moves away and adapts himself in other directions. And I think you see that a lot in those last years of the revolution, people who are excluded from the halls of power, sort of turning to other arena, journalism or independent organizing or something like that. So it's really interesting to me how these events shape their lives and really, yeah, and take them in directions that they didn't fully expect.
Deborah, I was thinking of Maréchal precisely in that respect, a young 20-year-old who's very gifted and who gets this important post at the library of a major college in Paris and blasts himself out of that, with another element that I find incredible in its presence in revolutionary writings, and which is coming to the fore perhaps much more now because we're more aware of it, which is that of play. Maréchal writes a tract on equality, disguising it as a strange book found in strange circumstances, après le déluge, or saved by from the flood, with the name of the author is an anagram of his own name. Buonarroti, it has wind of rebellion against the Tsarina by a Chechenian rebel, and we think news only travel fast in our days, but that's another story. And he appropriates the name of the leader of this revolution, this rebellion, Sheikh Mansour, and writes under the guise of translation a tract on equality that he could never have written because he was already in trouble with the Grand Duke. So in that sense.
So we were interested in translation and poetics, and this is why I'm really also grateful to Dominic for creating a beautiful art book in a way out of these words that so often are treated like propaganda. Like it's just like this, people have one reason why they write it, and this is the reason, and this is the outcome, and this is not poetry, because poetry has to be something that's not instrumentalized in any way. But I think what Christina said about the idea of play, because I've been looking at a lot of revolutionary theater lately, and it's just the amount of creativity and play that any revolution has. But that too was repressed after that directory moment, right? And what was also repressed was a certain idea of creativity and understanding of the role of the public, of the audience. And I think only after 68, maybe, or I mean, after the 20th century, I would say not after 68, but after 1917 and then again at 68, did we come back and maybe recover these more creative expressions of revolution? Because people have gone back to the innovations in theater, right? And all of a sudden they were thinking, oh, this is really an attempt to do a theater without walls. That's what we call it now. But for the revolution, it was also what they called it back then. So I think the creativity in the play travels in a way. It also has its closure, moments of closure and moments of opening and moments of rediscovery. But the other thing I think that connects these two very different books and approaches is, I think both your book, Laura, and our project does try to recreate the historical moment as a presence. And you know, so you do a real kind of play by play almost. So you're kind of in the moment, mm-hmm. a moment where, and it's a moment shot through with retrospective, because everyone's constantly adjusting what they think is the relationship between what they're doing and the future they're trying to bring about and the past that they've come from. And that this is kind of taking place simultaneously is, I think, a really important aspect to capture about a revolution. And I think I really appreciated that in the book, because there isn't a sense of judgment on the people either. I think we always tend to say, oh, so-and-so became a turncoat. Some people are more obviously turncoats than others, but many people were just trying to adjust to an extremely changeable situation. And I think to recover that moment in its fullness rather than reduce it is nice. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. And if I can add another layer onto that, was my own experience writing the book, because I had been working on this book for a long time, but seeing American politics veer rightward really galvanized me and sort of brought me, it's the one good thing I can say about this particular period in American history, was like how it helped me finish this book, because I felt as though watching the equals sort of assess what, and their allies assess what had happened and how they were to make sense of that and how they were to move forward. And that at the same time, I sort of felt that my own present was in dialogue with that past, and that what I was watching around me, I would see reflected in what I saw in the courtroom, and what I saw in the courtroom, I would see reflected around me. And I think in particular, that's why, I don't know how much that comes through in the book, but I have a really sort of pained relationship with Antonelle in particular, because he seems to me to have a really clear sense of what's coming. And it's just, it's excruciating to sort of see someone living that and kind of working that through. And that, I think too, is another link with the anarchist playbook, is the degree to which I'm sort of using the present to illuminate the past. And I think you're using the past to illuminate the present, and that there's this kind of springiness between these two periods in both of our books.
Can I ask a question about that? Because I've been incubating this for a while, and it's really for all of you, because it struck me that you're all in your different fields engaged in practices of translation. You know, if we go back to the kind of hoary cliche of the past as a foreign country, you're all trying to make, and that sounds too laborious, you're all looking to this past period and trying to translate it into terms that will connect with an audience that, as Sonia said at the beginning, you know, for whom the revolution, the French Revolution, is kind of, you know what happened, like back in antiquity, but it's not present. It's not a presence, as to use your phrase just now. And I wondered if all of you in different, you know, if you want to, would like to talk about the challenges of doing that, whether as a writer, a teacher, a publisher, a translator, how do you bridge that gap and stay true to the integrity of your materials, to a sense of difference between then and now, as well as the connections between then and now?
I just wanted to hop in there to kind of follow on from something that you'd said earlier, Sonia, that I keep thinking about as the conversation progresses. But when you were touching on the kind of student production of the Maréchal play, and in lieu of being able to kind of show the volcano that is so key, we have to discuss the volcano. And I think that's kind of what we're really circling around at the moment, that just in terms of finding different ways of formally, colloquially, creatively displaying and challenging the idea of the volcano and thinking about the inferences of that tectonic movement, that's fundamental. And so kind of for my part as a publisher, it's really thinking about that in terms of, you know, my role is to give you an object that can travel with you, that can inform an argument and a conversation that I will not be a part of down the line, but the book will try its best to be volcanic in some way, shape or form, or dynamic in that iota, right? And so thinking about the frameworks involved and how best to display the potentiality of a volcano of that kind of degree of potential charge is key. And it's something we're talking about here in terms of how we deal with the cumulative qualities of revolution and how the past feeds into our present articulation of the 21st century, right? As we're living through a consistent moment of catastrophe that shapeshifts and galvanizes in more horrific ways on a day-by-day basis, right? Whether we're talking war in Gaza or we're looking through to the lurch to the right, as you're pointing to, Laura, in the States over the last few years, that we're within a mode whereby the vitality of finding different ways in which to articulate this volcano is more important than ever, really, I think, to be honest. And so again, it's like, you know, as I was trying to articulate earlier on, that just to look back to the equals and the ways in which there was a deliberate effort to not just explore the value of speech, but explore how that, how a matrix of different forms of speech could be made manifest in paper is fascinating, really. And that doesn't really answer your question directly, but there's just like an inadvertent atmosphere that had to be pointed to, I felt.
In terms of thinking about both translation, linguistic translation, and historical translation, and here I defer to the translators. Sonia, if you sort of feel intimidated by my historical expertise, I'm intimidated by your translator's expertise. But, you know, my sense is that when you're doing a translation, there are different ways of approaching it. And I think that the idea that a translation has to be, what does it mean that a translation has to be as close as possible to the original? Does that mean that you're going to preserve the syntax, the sort of order of words, or are you going to try to make those words and those ideas present in a different dimension, in a different language? And I think that translating the past is the same kind of problem. And I run up against this all the time, both as a writer and as a teacher, that I find that my present often helps me understand at a gut level something much better than I would, than I have understood it intellectually. So how do I translate that present understanding into the past? And when I raise that with students, the trick is to get them to use what they know about their world as a way of understanding the past without necessarily becoming anachronistic. You know, this figure in the past is not this figure in the present, but how is it that what we know about war or exclusion or radicalism or hopefulness, how do those things that we know translate and help us better understand either the past or this text that we're bringing from another language? So I think it's a real challenge, but for me, that's where the real excitement is too. And returning to that question you raised at the beginning, Sonia, about what does the revolution mean today? And I think part of the problem is that, and I say this in my book, but I think the part of the problem is that the way we talk about the French Revolution is still so often a way of thinking about the French Revolution that corresponds to the experience of the 20th century. And it's finding what the revolution can say to the 21st century that's going to sort of bring it back to the front of people's minds.
Yes, well, translation, I think there's so many levels. I think on the level of deontology, it's a question of accepting and almost practicing or an awareness of your provisional conclusion. A position that is always liable to changing, not in obsequy to market laws or to opportunity, but simply to how discourse evolves. So that is the first, paradoxically, it's a tenet of non-stability that makes your practice more stable. I'm thinking of thinkers such as in Italy, Fulvio Jezzi, for example, who's one of the major critics of his time and who wrote extensively on right-wing culture, on the danger of these of memory intended as a set of marble slabs that purport to be reality and everything else is not real. A lot of our practice is mangrove-rooted on cultivating an unstable terrain. So that on the level of our positionality of where our position is. And on the technical level, on the paradox. It was William Blake who said, without minute neatness of execution, the sublime cannot exist. And I can't improve on that. In the sense, you know, when you are in dialogue with a classroom of young people, and you're needing to really make clear the wonderful paradox that every real art is based on. Each art has its own, but generally speaking, you have a very basic foundation. The more accurate you can be with the technical aspect of your work, the more your famed creativity can shine. But you can't start from the opposite place. We are pushed all the time to cultivate a completely fallacious dichotomy between art and science, or between poetry and the so-called real world. No, this is a very recent, relatively recent development, if we think of the history of ideas, and one that I think we should resist. So in terms of what you were saying earlier, Laura, about what to do with the text of this time-honored age, literally it is a question of blowing the dust off the accumulation of the preconceptions or assumptions that has encrusted it. One, B, of not assuming our own competence a priori. Maybe it's not the author being deliberately obscure, maybe it's me who needs to know a bit more about 18th century French. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, understanding, and that's done through two things. We talk of close reading, but also distant reading. So, you know, you have to have both, and you have to see the text and not the words. That this is a process that you are looking at, and you need to get into the tone, the mood that the author is trying to, like it or not, in French we would say imposer, if you he's trying to change the mood in a certain space, so even if that space is only your own. So the tone is the core of everything. Start from that, and then the words will follow, because if you go to the opposite end, you risk, and there are many translations sadly who do that, who will say, oh, I've kept the rhyme structure, but so what? The original was an ode and an elegy, and you made a nursery rhyme, but you feel clever because you've got the rhymes. Well, maybe not. So mm-hmm. Tone first, and everything else will follow suit.
Yeah, can I just say, yeah, this is what was very fascinating for me. So I want to just be clear that Christina ran the workshops. I was just a participant in the workshops because I am not a gifted translator myself. But the idea of tone, so there's a couple of things that I want to say. Is one is the revolution, I think, is not very visible anymore for a variety of reasons. And one of the problems with the French Revolution is it's become a French phenomenon. So mm-hmm. they teach it obviously in France in school because it's part of their national history. And I think our bigger radical translations project was trying to recover, we're not allowed to say the word international anymore, it's not, but let's say transnational dimension of the revolution. We focused on the European context just because that's what we were able to do, but also because there was a kind of geographical proximity and connection between people that made sense. But so we want to fight against that it's just something for a nation state to teach its own students in high school, let's say, or something. Mm-hmm. I think the French Revolution has always been difficult to actually teach, probably in Britain. I mean, I'm not in a history department. I know there's very respectable historians of the French Revolution in Britain, but I think there's something about British national history as well where they often portray themselves, well, we got there anyway without the revolution, so why do you need the revolution? That's not something for us. So already just working in Britain on a French culture, which is what I do as part of my department, makes it, there's so many things that don't translate and that are difficult to pass. So I think that's one reason why attention to language in particular is relevant. The other reason is, of course, is that no one reads French anymore. Mm-hmm. So our students can't read the original documents. And so always when we have any project, and this book is so beautiful, and I'm hoping we'll be able to put it on a syllabus and use it, because I think otherwise it's impossible to teach. And it's especially difficult to teach linguistic artifacts. You could maybe teach a David painting or tell people what happened in the revolution by getting them to look at sources themselves or plays. It's very difficult. So that's just a pragmatic perspective. And the other thing, Dominic mentioned this kind of impossibility of staging the volcano today and the sense that we're living on a catastrophic, like an edge of a catastrophe. And I think what we like about the revolution is that it is catastrophic, but there's an optimism in it and a sense of play in it and a sense of future in it and trying to recover a future dimension and not just have a terrible catastrophe is part of what I think keeps the revolution alive as a phenomenon. Also, someone once described to me recently, whether we like it or not, revolution is a natural force. I think that came across in Laura in your book. But that's something that, you know, as academics, you're not always, you forget because you're in your ideas and you think about, you know, books and things like that. So I think that's also something that we wanted to capture. But what Christina said about tone has been our biggest challenge, because I think one of the reasons why for a long time revolution isn't really accepted is because it's difficult to translate this tone. And someone once told me that they think that the reason English-speaking people don't like the revolution is it's because the rhetoric of the convention translates badly. That was a theory that someone presented to me once over a coffee at a conference. And there might be some truth to that. And the tone of aggressive words, anger, and as Laura's book really shows, Babouf personally having suffered so much, his children dying of starvation, I mean, just this terrible personal experience, that voice for a long time, I think, hasn't been acceptable in a classroom, really. Maybe now things are changing again. But how do you translate that tone, which is not just pure anger? And this is where I think Christina was really able to get into it very nicely with our students, because it's hard-hitting vocabulary and strong words that are nonetheless, there's tensions in them, there's paradoxes that need to be unfolded, and there's a classical element and a poetic element that needs to be retained as well. And I think on the level of emotion and tone, I think that's where I found students are highly receptive to studying the revolution from that point of view. And they're able to do it as people who don't know anything. That was really important for us. So we never framed what they were doing. We just gave them the text. I mean, I spoke maybe for 5 minutes to say, you know, there was this conspiracy once, this is what happened. Because I felt that we didn't want to have a mediating authority, which would be me just because I was their teacher and I marked their papers sometimes. And it's really important that this workshop was extracurricular, wasn't for marks, and was something that people did voluntarily. Because the minute you have a different motivation, something else happens. So it's kind of a long-winded way to talk about several things, but I think the tone of the revolution is a very fascinating question for us today. And it's always been used against it, I think, right?
It's interesting that I didn't realize until just now that this was an extracurricular activity. And I like that. And it brings me back to something you were saying earlier about plays and plays, kind of the experimental play falling out of fashion until 68. Because I think that when we talk about plays, it's not just the theatrical text, it's also the idea of playfulness. And most governments don't like playfulness because you can't control where it goes or what it does or how people are going to take it in. And I think that by having an extracurricular translation project, you were reintroducing playfulness. And playfulness doesn't necessarily have to mean funny. It's that idea of engaging with something and seeing where it takes you. And I think that that's precisely how you bring an idea of revolution to life, is let people play with it and see where it takes them.
Yeah, and I would just say our students now are not, that's not what they're geared towards. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's not a moment particularly in which this is something that's commonplace, because actually we did find, we in a way we were lucky, because some of these collaborative translations, because it involved also students in France and in Italy, we were lucky in a way that COVID happened, because we continued these translations through COVID, and then all of a sudden people really needed it. Mm-hmm. You could really tell that it had become existential. But now that we're back out of COVID, and people are again just trying to get a job and get a career and move on and insert themselves in the world, it's very hard, I would say, to continue the energy of a project like this. And we were only able to do it, really, I would say, because Christina really believed in it. It was just hard work getting the students and organizing it when it's not in an it's somewhat institutionalized, obviously. It's part of a grant that I was running, but it was a bit para-institutional, and you need a lot of commitment.
Students and young people, I think they're so pushed at the moment to live up to a totally fictitious idea of what the so-called real world will be like, and to present themselves as marketable first and foremost, that whichever small thing we can do to say, well, life is also about something else. You are young people and you have a right to do something and get bored, to do something else, to relate to your lecturers not as a customer service, despite the fact that the government is trying by introducing fees to turn them into such, or figures of that are trying to impose something on you, but to continue that dialogue, to create that dialogue. Every small thing that we can do in that direction is of value to them. I think when we say things that are sometimes in danger of being viewed with irony or excess irony. A great Italian poet says, for a little irony, all is lost, because we push to be worldly wise before our time, and that can be a problem. And you say things like friendship. These people, these guys who went to the guillotine were a bunch of friends whose kids had died. And, you know, young or old people can relate very, very readily to that. And also we had, I don't know, I was very heartened by the level of understanding brought to bear by the students on the text. When we were working on the play, and the play has a lot of elements that are very difficult for a contemporary reader. So we were looking at ways that we could leave an open mesh for the play, yes, to be rehearsed, yes, to be staged eventually, because that's the life of a play, without becoming a period piece. So we'd be just sort of drew on some experiences in the past of what the playwright did in the past. They staged rehearsals, for instance, so that now we can leave on one side a text that is as, shall we say, philologically accurate as we could, because that was also our intent. We have a translation that has to be there, pretty transparent, but we leave it open to interventions at the place of staging, including Dongik, the famous volcano, which we'll get there somehow.
But I don't know, Laura, if this is how you feel, that there's a difficulty nowadays, because you're at least in a history department. So I don't really know. I'm not in a history department. So there's even less occasion to teach revolution as a historical event. So I have to always approach it through other material. But if there's a difficulty in teaching.
I mean, it's interesting, because I find that every time I teach the French Revolution alternate years, and I'm fortunate in being part of a history department that has a lot of people working on Atlantic revolutions. So even if they don't know anything about France, they might know something about the Haitian Revolution and the American Revolution. But it's interesting, because I find each time I teach the revolution, my students come in with a set of ideas that are really kind of ideas forged in the present that shape how they approach the revolution. The last time I taught this class was less than a year after the insurrection of January 6th here in the United States, and trying to help my students think through the difference between kinds of insurrections and what insurrections are aiming for. Is it an insurrection for democracy or against democracy is a real challenge. I think outside of the classroom, Americans aren't all that interested in the French Revolution. Like, I mean, you said that in Britain, there's this kind of sense of, well, like we got there and we didn't even have to have a revolution. The myth about the American Revolution is that it wasn't a violent revolution. And while historians are changing what they say about that, there is still this American myth that, like, we got the revolution right. Well, why did the French do it this way? And so I think that it's both that sense of somehow the French got it wrong and the Americans got it right, but also a sort of general insularity in American thinking that can make encouraging people to, like, think about the revolution a challenge. And I think it's no mistake that, I mean, I think it's consistent with that the students who tend to take my French Revolution class are overwhelmingly, if they're not history students, they're international studies students.
I mean, it seems like that's a really good place to end, but does anyone have final thoughts they wanted to throw into the mix?
Okay. You'd asked us to talk about, the title Anarchy. And I just want to say two things. One is that it is a contentious title because obviously there's a long tradition that doesn't see Babeuf and Buonarroti as anarchists, but as communists or first communists, very organized. But I found in Laura Mason's book a justification for why we can keep the title Anarchy in our book. And it really struck me, and it's on page 121, I believe, when Boisy d'Anglas talks about the constitution of year two as being organized anarchy. Is it our term or is it in the period? Originally, we intended, and Dominic liked the title Anarchy, he wanted to keep it. We had this discussion, do we keep it, do we not keep it? And it seems to me, actually, it's in the period as well. So it's not just our label that we thought we would put in because we wanted to reflect our working process. It's actually interesting that I think if we did a word search, Laura, in your book, the word anarchy comes up as a pejorative term, usually.
Usually as a pejorative term, yeah, because it was mostly people on the right who used that term during the revolution. But as I thought about this question too, it strikes me, they both believe that if you give people enough information, they will take matters into their own hands and rise up. And so there is this kind of faith in an upswelling of activism, that the organization that happens is not a kind of putting people in their ranks, but saying, talk to your neighbors, listen to what they're saying, think about what you can do, read these pamphlets. And so I think that in that sense too, and I think that it's in that spirit that I see your work as well.
Many thanks to Laura Mason, Sonia Perovich, Christina Vitti, and Dominic Jakeley for taking part in this conversation. You can learn more about them and their work on the episode page for this podcast. Please visit our website, historyworkshop.org.uk. You can find us on X at HistoryWO and on Facebook and Instagram as History Workshop. This is the History Workshop podcast. I'm Mary Beth Hamilton. Thanks for listening.